I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Addiction can take many forms, from compulsively checking your phone to smoking cigarettes to binge eating. But how do you break the cycle for good? Today, we meet a psychologist who's using mindfulness training to help his patients curb their bad habits. But first, the number of kids in Kansas's foster care system has hit a record high. It's so high, in fact, that foster kids in the state were sleeping in department offices because of a lack of other options. Needless to say, the agency has been under fire. We'll sit down with the head of the Kansas Department of Children and Families to hear her plans to turn things around. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. To say that Gina Meyer Hummel is on the hot seat is putting it mildly. The new secretary for the Kansas Department of Children and Families takes over a position rife with controversy. The biggest concern is what this agency is doing to keep children from dying of abuse and neglect. There have been ongoing issues over the number of kids missing from the state's foster care system, as well as children forced to sleep in state offices when placements can't be found. The state Senate recently confirmed her appointment amid praise that Meyer Hummel will be an agent of change for an agency that very much needs it. Secretary Gina Meyer Hummel joins us now here in the studio, and welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Well, why did you want this job, Gina? It just seems like this office faces one controversy after another.
Well, this is what I've done with my career. So I've worked in child welfare, and I've worked in and around the state and in this arena, and this is where my passion is, and helping families, at-risk families and children is what I'm passionate about.
What keeps you up at night?
Kids.
Kids'
safety. Yeah, kids' safety, making sure we're doing the right thing. Making sure we're making good decisions.
Well, as of today, then, what can you say to the people of Kansas to assure them that this agency is keeping abused kids, foster care kids in this state safe from harm? Because the record of late is checkered, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge issue, of course. As I was contemplating today, one of the things I wanted to talk about was just drug usage in general in our state and in our country, and certainly how that then leads to child abuse. I think one of the things we haven't really spoke of is really how that's impacting families. And I think it's important for folks to know. In particular, meth usage is a huge issue facing families in our state, and something that we really need to get on and get moving on and get focused on. So that's one of the areas we'll be looking at moving forward.
You're seeing a direct corollary between drug use and how kids and families oftentimes are treated.
Yeah, well, I think there's a definite correlation between at-risk children and meth usage, and then how that then perpetuates at-risk for those families. I do think, we're doing lots of things, of course. We've changed personnel. We have consultants in helping us look at our system. We have policy changes in place. We're working on training for our staff. We have, again, consultants coming, looking at the front end of our system, looking at what should we change. We have system changes in process in terms of like the Protection Report Center and what we're doing to respond to calls.
So what's the biggest change you've implemented? It's a lot of stuff, a lot of change to a system. What's the biggest one?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. We're going back over the Protection Report Center. That's where the calls come in. And so we really are working to make sure that we are responsive to those calls quickly, timely, efficiently, effectively. A lot of calls come in there, and we're working really hard to process redesign that system in particular, because it's the first chance we get to intervene with families. And so that's a big focus of what we're working on. We certainly are working on oversight of our contractors for when kids come into foster care. Then what are our contractors doing? How are they taking care of the children that are in the secretary's care? So I don't know that there's any one focus, because I don't think we are afforded the luxury of just focusing in one particular area.
I'm visiting with Gina Meyer Hummel. She's She's a new secretary for the Kansas Department of Children and Families. Do you have enough employees, and are you able to pay them well enough to get the kind of people you'd like to work for DCF going forward?
We certainly don't have enough employees. I mean, that's one of the big things that, again, we're working on and that we have an initiative about is doing more recruitment for social workers.
How short are you?
I don't have the number today. Pretty short, though. I mean, in some offices and areas, 50% of the staff, are down positions, open positions. So we do have fairly significant shortages in different parts of the state.
How can you look after kids when you're down 50% in some offices?
It's a difficulty for sure. So we have ongoing recruitment plans, and we're certainly, we have raised the starting salary for social workers and for our investigators. Again, recognize that it is extremely difficult work. We talked about that, there's not one magic answer. You have to get in, you have to assess family situation, you have to assess their needs, then you have to figure out what works for them. So it's a very difficult work, and it takes a lot of thought and a lot of study about families and what you do to intervene with them.
Again, are you able to pay them enough, Gina, that you can attract, again, the quality of worker that you want to see working for the state?
Well, I don't know that we'll ever be able to pay folks what they're worth to do this job and to do this work, because, again, it's very difficult work. I do think most of the people who come to do this work come because they're passionate about helping families, just as I'm passionate about helping families. That's what drives people to come in every day, is to really be able to serve families and serve them well. When we do have something that goes wrong, it certainly impacts our staff as well as, obviously it impacts the public and impacts the families that are involved, but it does in a direct way impact the workers who are involved.
At the time of your Senate confirmation, State Senator Laura Kelly, a Democrat from Topeka, said of your agency that there was nowhere to go but up. Does that sound about right?
I certainly think we have a lot of things to do in order to improve our system.
Yeah. Let's turn to some of the specific issues that you face these days. One is responding to reports of abused kids in the state. Case in point, 3-year-old Evan Brewer, whose body was discovered encased in concrete in his South Wichita rental home in September by a landlord. This was obviously before you took over, Gina, but the Wichita Eagle just reported that a former DCF worker said that your agency missed opportunity after opportunity to investigate and possibly save 3-year-old Evan Brewer. Too often, the Eagle's report said DCF workers took the mother's word that the boy was okay. What happened there?
Well, obviously, as we've spoke about publicly, we're not going to go into too much detail because the families said they were going to litigate. And of course, we'll need to be part of the court process. But we have owned for sure the mistakes outright that we know that we've made. And I think second to that, what I would say is, having done the line work, it's always easier to come behind and second guess than it is to be in the middle of an investigation. And
I was going to say, there's a lot of armchair quarterbacking that goes on with the work of DCF across the state of Kansas, right?
That's correct. I mean, I think that, when you're investigating and you're looking at things and you're trying to respond to remember that plus 20 other cases, you're doing the very best you can. I'm not saying that we always get it right. For sure we don't. But I think it's much easier to come behind and look and go, oh, you should have done that differently.
There were allegations by a state senator in that case, state senator from Johnson County, her name is Barbara Beaulieu, that someone in the state's child welfare agency had actually altered records in the case of Evan Brewer. What can you tell us about that?
We did own that there was a misstep there that was, again, done before my time in terms of something that a worker had done, and it's not okay and it's not acceptable, and we've made changes to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Is that worker still employed by the state of Kansas?
No.
Another more local case involves 7-year-old Adrian Jones, who was repeatedly tortured, his body ultimately fed to pigs in 2015. It's been alleged that records in both Kansas and Missouri reveal a seemingly endless series of reports and hotline calls informing social service and child welfare agency of the abuse that Adrian suffered. What happened in that case?
Well, again, not going into any details about any particular case, I would say that when families move back and forth across state lines, again, the whole communication and the whole need to share information becomes that much more critical.
And coordination breaks down sometimes.
Well, certainly there's that opportunity for things to break down, yes.
Yeah. What do stories like this do to morale at DCF offices around the state? You referred to it already. What happens?
Well, I think one of the things that things like this, you know, you forget that there are thousands of other things that are going right, that there are thousands of other children situations where had we not intervened and intervened correctly, they wouldn't be graduating from high school, or they wouldn't be safely with foster families, or they wouldn't be safely with their grandparents. And never do we hear the stories about where we effectively intervened with families, but it happens daily, 1,000 times a day. So, I mean, again, it's important to pay attention to the things that go wrong. And when we miss an opportunity to intervene, it's a tragedy. There's no doubt about it. And we need to look at it and see what we can do differently. But we certainly need to recognize that the staff work really hard, that certainly nobody wants to see a child endangered, that's not what anybody gets up in the morning and, you know, that's not their goal. Their goal is to effectively intervene with families. And then when people second guess, or when there's the second guess going on, or when there's the media barrage, in particular in naming workers or naming, you know, the staff are involved, that's really difficult to say, come back and do it again tomorrow and do your very best you can.
So. Can you guarantee that something like this won't happen again?
You can never guarantee that. I mean, and I talk about this. I've been doing this work for 25 years, and we could do the very best work we can and intervene, and we could walk out of a house and something tragic happens. So there are no guarantees in any of the work that we do.
Again, Gina Meyer-Hummel is my guest. She's a new secretary for the Kansas Department of Children and Families. You know, there have been reports, even in recent weeks, of gag orders and demands that the parents of kids who have died after those families have had contact with your social workers not speak with reporters. Are those gag orders still in effect?
I don't know the particulars of, I mean, I've kind of heard of the situations you're speaking of, and I don't know, again, all before my time. I certainly know that there are legal processes that take place in order to release information when a tragedy occurs. And so I think that's the particulars of what you're speaking of, is that was a situation where the court had ordered us not to release information until such time as the court allows for that release to occur.
But what I'm talking about is DCF workers actually going out and proactively approaching parents of families where a tragedy has occurred and asking those families not to speak to reporters at any time.
I've certainly heard the same reports you have. I've never heard of that under my watch.
And that practice wouldn't be tolerated?
Not at all.
But what about reports of shredded documents by DCF workers so that the media can't get access to those documents through open records requests? Is that practice still ongoing?
Again, I think that's a story that it has kind of gotten taken out of context, as I've understand it and asked questions about it. But certainly we talk about documenting and documenting all that goes on and keeping those records for sure.
And not shredding them.
Correct.
How are you ensuring more sunlight into your agency? Because that's been a big focus of the media, the Kansas City Star, through its transparency series that just concluded. What are you doing on that front?
Well, certainly having conversations like this with others, with other
media
outlets.
This is the first, by the way, in the history of this program, and I appreciate it, by the way.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I think the work is so important that we have to talk about it and we have to help people understand. I get the criticism I get when they see things that are public, and they have questions about what we're doing. But so it's important to have the conversation. I'm sorry, I forgot your question. I mean, obviously having the conversations we're having, I think one of the other things we're working really hard at is, again, telling what we're doing to address certain things, making sure that the public knows that we hear them, that we understand that we don't like it when bad things happen to kids. And then we certainly are, of course, we have a law moving through the legislature right now that will hopefully guarantee for years to come that we'll continue to tell more of the story so that secretaries after me are, you know, kind of forced to make sure that we're accountable to the public with which we serve. I think the other thing is we are working really hard to put our public work plans out on our website so people can keep track of the reform so they can see what all has changed. So we'll have very soon some information about what our goals are per program and what we're working on and what our work plans are so that people know and can keep track of, are you doing what you said you were going
to
do?
Your commitment to transparency is what, just broadly speaking?
We want people to know. I mean, we work for the public. We want them to know what we're doing. We want them to know what we're addressing. We want them to know what we're so we're committed to being as transparent as we can be. Obviously, we have to protect the very sensitive nature.
There are limits.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's very sensitive family situations that we are involved with every day, and we don't want to overshare, and we certainly, you know, don't want to undershare. So it is a fine balance.
The other issue you've been involved with, Gina, that has garnered a whole lot of attention is the number of missing kids in the foster care system. These are children that you don't know their whereabouts at any given moment. The number of kids missing from foster care has varied, you know, averaging 82 kids missing per month, peaking in November at 93 children. How big a concern is this? And I'm wondering, this is a problem I assume that other state foster care agencies share as well.
It is. So this is a prime example, and I'm glad you asked, because this is an example of where we are making a difference. The number today is 64, which, again, not that one too many, one away from a placement is too many, but it's down significantly from where it has been. It is one of those things that I think, again, has probably been taken a little bit out of context. The children who are missing are children who a lot of them have ran away from their placements, have left their placements voluntarily. Recognize that children who are in foster care don't have a lot of control over their situation, and oftentimes they've been removed from homes and didn't really want to be removed from their homes and didn't really have a say in that process.
So they hit the road.
So this is one way for them to kind of control what's going on in their environment. So that's a lot of those youth, or youth who've left their placement voluntarily. It doesn't make it okay. It doesn't mean they're safe. It certainly means we're worried about them and we want them back in a safe placement, but it is not an unknown phenomenon to the country in terms of children in foster care. They do this. They certainly are at risk, and we're working really hard to get them back and get them into treatment and get them help so that they don't feel like they need to, you know, lash out in that way.
This is a problem that is common, what, with other state welfare agencies as well?
It is.
Kansas is not unique here.
That's true.
Would a goal of zero, is that a realistic goal? Will you ever see zero?
No, probably not.
Okay, so there always will be some number of children who are missing here.
Right, and I mean, we'll find children, we'll do interventions, and then they can leave again from their placement. So it is something that, you know, that even if we find them tomorrow, that number could go back up.
You know, there were reports a few months ago that some foster care children were forced to sleep in state DCF contractor offices because homes couldn't be found for them. Is that still happening?
Yes, unfortunately, there's not necessarily enough placements for the number of children that are currently in foster care. And so what happens is when a child comes into foster care, we generally have 4 hours to find a placement for them. And you can imagine that if there's a large sibling group or if there's a child with extreme needs, that they may have to sleep a night in an office while we find an appropriate placement for them or find a placement for them to be together. Certainly, we're working on that. We have all kinds of initiatives in the works to resolve that so that we end that practice quickly. But yes, unfortunately, today that still happens. But
there's a need for more foster care parents and families in the state of Kansas.
There's a need for more foster parents. There's a need for more group home parents. There's a need for more hospital beds. There's a need for more psychiatric beds. So we have a need across the entire continuum of care.
And one reason is because the number of kids in foster care, if I understand correctly, it's growing, right? It's not shrinking.
It's at an all-time high in Kansas, yes.
What is that number roughly?
7,300.
7,300. Mm-hmm. And 10 years ago, what was it? Would it be less than that?
5,400, something like that.
So we're going up in significant ways. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things. I mean, I think that certainly the economy, again, not unique just to Kansas. Let me say that across the country, I think they're seeing spikes in the foster care population across the state. I mean, across the country. So it's not unique just to Kansas. Certainly, we know that, again, as I spoke of earlier about the usage of drugs and how that's impacting many families in Kansas and putting kids at risk, that's a huge issue, again, across our country. You certainly see, as we had The economy, global economy in our country, as it, you know, families were at risk and jobs and locking jobs. So I think globally, those things have had an impact on at-risk families.
You know, it seems like in recent years that Kansas has been moving away from putting kids in group homes, and it's done pretty well at that. Kids sleeping in offices sounds a lot like putting kids in a group home. Is that, am I seeing that right?
Well, certainly it's not, none of that is a preferred practice. You want children to be with family. You want them to be with extended kin. You want them to be with their relatives. You want them to be in foster family. And then, yes, you want them to be in a group home as a last resort.
Last week, your agency came out in support of a bill that would let organizations refuse placements with families, including gay and lesbian couples, based on religious beliefs. This came after you had said in December, Gina, that the agency would have zero tolerance, and that's a quote, for discrimination in adoption and foster care cases. That sounded to me like a glaring discrepancy. Help me with that.
Well, it's not, because we still will allow for gay and lesbian couples to foster and adopt. It's simply allowing other people to also sit at the table. If we have a lack of resources and there's folks who aren't currently at our table because of certain things, we need to look at what our laws are that will allow for other people to come next to us and help us with at-risk kids.
Because you need more people in the system, it sounds like.
We need more people helping kids, yes.
Okay. One final area. Your agency oversees food stamps and cash assistance as well. KU has been working on a study that shows that welfare restrictions put into place under former Governor Sam Brownback are connected to the skyrocketing numbers of kids in state care. What about that?
We have data that disputes that. We've been in contact with KU. We've looked at the data. We don't believe that the data points as pointedly as they suggest it is to that as an issue. In fact, we've looked at the correlation across the entire country and can see no correlation between states that have enacted welfare reform and their population of foster care. Again, it's foster care. You can't come into foster care for poverty-related reasons alone. There has to be other things going on, and the court oversees who comes into foster care.
But still, these days, cash assistance for a family of three in Kansas is $429 a month. That number hasn't been raised since at least 1996. That's $429 is just 25% of the federal poverty level. Do you advocate for higher payouts? I mean, that's a terrific strain on poor families.
Well, we're advocating for folks to get employed, and that's what we've seen as a result of the welfare reform, is that more people are employed and that more people are getting better jobs and being able to take care of their families and live independently.
Is $429 a month enough in your view? Do you advocate for higher numbers?
I would have to look and see where we're at in terms of, I think, again, the piece is really making sure that families are connected to gainful employment. So that's our focus.
I was telling Gina before the show today that every year on a show that Nick Haynes at KCPT does, he has an annual roundup of the year's news, and he always asks, who's got the toughest job in the metro? I think Gina Meyer-Humble is going to be my nomination going into 2018 and down the road. Thank you so much for visiting with us. I sure appreciate it, and good luck with your work.
Thank you so much.
That's Gina Meyer-Hummel. She's the new head of the Department of Children and Families in the state of Kansas. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about ways to break that addiction, even to your cell phone. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, we sat down with three Kansas City Council members to discuss the biggest issues facing the neighborhoods along and east of Troost Avenue. You can hear that conversation and all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we sit down with the developer for Kansas City's new single terminal airport to find out where the project stands now and what the next stages are. Then a look at how folks in western Kansas are dealing with wildfire season. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, we're all vulnerable to addiction. There isn't much doubt about that. Whether it's compulsive responses to our smartphones every time they chirp, to overeating, to smoking cigarettes or marijuana, bad habits are all around us. The question today is, how do we break them? How do we move away from a bad habit that has preoccupied us, possibly for years? Dr. Judson Brewer has spent a lot of time thinking about bad habits, and he's our next guest today. His focus is on something called mindfulness, and we're about to find out more about that. Judson Brewer is the director of research at the Center for Mindfulness, and he's an associate professor in medicine and psychiatry at the UMass Medical School. He's also the author of the book, The Craving Mind. He joins us now via Skype. And Judson, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you said the inspiration for this book was 20 years of your own suffering. What were you struggling with?
How long do we have? Everything and anything. I mean, my mind was pretty crazy.
Well, in what way?
I was just starting to notice. So, you know, when I started medical school, actually, I started waking up to my own habits, my own compulsions, and just how much suffering I was getting, even to the point where I was having trouble sleeping after going through a relationship breakup where my mind kept going over and over, you know, like what had happened, for example.
One of the big things in your research and your work is mindfulness, as I just said. What do you mean by mindfulness? And is it just meditating or is it something more than that?
Yeah, I don't think of it. I think of meditation as a way to support mindfulness, but we can think of mindfulness as being an awareness that we all have the capacity for. Yet we bring this particular attitude where we start to notice when we're being pushed and pulled, when we're being sucked into wanting things, you know, that are pleasant to continue, and when we're also reflexively pushing things away that we don't like. That mindfulness is around seeing that push and pull very, very clearly so that we can step out of those habit loops, so to speak.
So what you're saying is mindfulness is noticing the world from something of a detached point of view. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I would say detached yet actually fully engaged, if that might sound paradoxical. So we have the perspective to not be, you know, not have it so in our face that we're attached, you know, we're so caught up in it we don't even notice it. But we're not detached in the way that detached often is described, where we're kind of, far away from it. We're actually really engaged.
How hard is it to learn?
I would say it's, you know, we can actually tap into our own brain's capacity to do this. And awareness is something that we all have a very natural capacity for. So in that sense, it's really not that hard.
And this can help us not only chill out, but also break bad habits. Walk us through that a little bit.
Well, if you think of from a neuroscientific standpoint, I think of it as, you know, how can I understand how my mind and how our minds work? And if we can understand how our minds work, then we can learn to work with them. So knowing some of the basics, for example, how these processes are set up, as in, you know, they're set up to help us remember where food is. If we can start to understand that process more, we can start to see how that gets hijacked in our modern day environment. You know, a simple example would be, you know, if you need several components for learning behaviors, for example, food-related things would be, you know, if we see some food and we eat it, and our stomach sends this dopamine signal to our brain that says, "Oh, that was nutritious food" or "that was calories." We can break this down to a simple process. You know, there's a trigger, there's a behavior, and there's a quote-unquote result or reward process. In modern-day society, where food is plentiful, and we start to learn to eat when we're stressed out or we're sad or we're mad, this is where we run into trouble. But if we can start to pay attention to that process and see, oh, I'm eating because I'm stressed, then we can start to step out of the cycle.
That's interesting. Where do you draw the line between, you know, say a bad habit and addiction? And at what point do you step back and say, I might be addicted to this?
Yeah, I like the simple definition of addiction, which is continued use despite adverse consequences. And in that way, this applies to smartphones, it applies to cigarettes, it applies to all sorts of things. So if we're, you know, for with our smartphones, for example, they're helpful. They certainly help me get around. But if I'm using it and or I'm looking at my smartphone instead of having an engaged conversation with my wife, you know, that there's some adverse consequences that come with that, and that might move more into the realm of addiction.
Does mindfulness training work equally on both bad habits and addiction?
Yes, I think of bad habits and addiction being along the same spectrum. So if a bad habit is biting my fingernails, you know, it's socially acceptable and doesn't necessarily make us lose our job if we bite our fingernails, yet it's a bad habit. Drinking on the job, on the other hand, we're more likely to lose our job. So I think both of those are along the same spectrum.
Judson Brewer is my guest. He's the director for research at the Center for Mindfulness. His new book, The Craving Mind, it's out in paperback. Let's talk about how to break a bad habit. Step one, you say, is to ask yourself, what do I get from this? Meaning what?
Yes. So if our brains, this process is called reward-based learning. And if our brains learn from rewards, you know, like, oh, it feels good to eat a cupcake, or oh, it feels good to, you know, give somebody the universal sign of displeasure when I'm cut off in traffic, you know, we can start to ask ourselves, what do I actually get from this? You know, if I'm eating that fourth cupcake and I'm not paying attention to the results, then I'm going to keep doing it. It's going to be habitual. But if I start paying attention to the results and see, oh, you know, I'm actually feeling not very good right now, this hacks into this natural reward-based learning process in our brain, and our brain updates the value of that reward. And that updated value comes back and says, hey, you know, you might not want to do that the next time we're in that situation. So we're actually hacking the system.
Step two, use a four-step process called RAIN. Let's start with the letter R in RAIN. It stands for what?
Recognize, because we have to recognize if we're about to be, if we are caught up in the loop. So that's what that R stands for. And then we can, that A stands for allow or accept, which is important because we tend to push these things away. If we have a craving, we want it to go away as fast as possible. And so we eat the cupcake quickly, and then that craving goes away temporarily. But if we can allow those sensations that cravings, that make up cravings, be there, then we can actually get toward turn toward them, which is the paradoxical element of mindfulness. Mindfulness is about turning toward rather than running away, and that's what that I. So RAI is for investigate.
Investigate, yeah.
Yeah, we can explore what's happening in our body right now, and this N is for note, where we can simply note these physical sensations that make up cravings. So they might be tightness or tension or burning or clenching, and we can start to see that these are just physical sensations rather than some moral imperative that we have to act on.
Give us an example of someone you've known that's tried this and it's worked, and how it managed to be as effective as it was.
Boy, I could give you a number because we now have these digital therapeutic programs that are delivering this stuff, whether it's for smoking or for eating or even for anxiety. So, for example, with eating, I'm thinking, you know, lots of folks in our community who actually talk about using RAIN to write out their cravings. So they first check in with themselves. Oh, here's this craving, and then they check to see, you know, are they pushing it away? And I'm thinking of a, you know. Think of a recent example, perhaps, where you know, somebody has an urge to eat after dinner. So nighttime snacking is a big thing for a lot of folks. And so they wander into the kitchen and it's like, oh, I want something, but I'm not really sure what it is. And so at that point, they can stop and check in with themselves. And instead of opening the cabinets or staring into the fridge, they can step back and then just drop into their body and see, oh, what does it feel like right now? What does it feel like? And then just for the next 10 or 15 seconds or however long the craving lasts, typically it's not that long, they can just get curious about what those sensations feel like as they ride that wave out. You know, we talk about it as urge surfing or riding the waves of craving.
I mean, that takes some real, you know, mental muscularity to ward this stuff off, doesn't it?
It can, especially until somebody learns it. So we, you know, this is why we've developed these digital therapeutic programs to walk people through the training, you know, little pieces at a time. So the first step is actually just to recognize that they're stuck in a habit loop. The second step is to ask that question, what do I get from this? And those first two pieces are actually building the mental muscle to then shift into what we think of as third gear, where folks are actually using practices like RAIN to ride out the cravings. I don't recommend somebody just rush into trying to use RAIN because they'll probably be doing it from a cognitive thinking level, which is not really what mindfulness is about. It's about really understanding the results of the behavior. And as we start to become disenchanted with, you know, eating that fourth cupcake or stress eating or eating at nighttime when we're bored, until we really get a sense for what that feels like in our body, we're going to be less motivated to ride out the cravings. Once we do have a sense of that, then it's much easier to step into this simple process of dropping in our bodies and noticing what these sensations feel like. And then that piece, as we practice, it gets easier and easier and easier. That's just tapping into our natural capacities to be aware.
Judson Brewer is my guest. His new book, The Craving Mind. This digital technology you're talking about, what is it and how can people connect to it?
That we're talking. So there's a new term, actually, digital therapeutics. The FDA just approved its first digital therapeutic last year. And that's just a fancy term for delivering evidence-based medicine through a smartphone. So, for example, we have a program called Eat Right Now, which is about eating correctly in the present moment.
Right.
Where people can just they can download the app and they, you know, there's a stepwise training. We have one for anxiety called Unwinding Anxiety. And so folks can just go and, you know, they're available on Apple and, you know, Google phones, and people can just find these things, download the app and try them out. They're short trainings where they get videos, animations, in the moment exercises. And we have these really robust communities. And I think community support's really important for changing habits. So these communities where folks can get support, I moderate the community so they can even, you know, interact with me and some of the other experts. And the idea is to package a training in a way that's going to meet with our modern society standards, which is, you know, at everybody's own convenience and at their own pace. So this is where instead of having people come into my clinic, I can take my clinic to them, so to speak.
You actually have online group therapy sessions, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's group therapy. We have these group support sessions where folks can, like once a week as part of these programs, they can actually just join us via a Zoom, you know, which is a Skype-like conversation. And we can all join via video from all over the world. And they can ask questions and I can respond to the questions and give them support and advice with regard to the trainings themselves. It's important because sometimes, you know, as you're talking, you and I are talking about these, mindfulness can sound simple, but it's not always easy to implement. And so it's really important to give people a forum for to be able to ask questions and make sure that they're doing the practices correctly.
If people are interested in the list of the different online programs you offer, where can they go, Judson?
Probably the simplest clearinghouse rather than our UMass website or whatever is just a judsonbrewer.com, mm-hmm. which has a list and a link to all of these different programs.
Yeah. With your definition of addiction as repeated use despite adverse consequences, it's hard not to think that many things could be considered addicting, like, say, dating or using social media. The list is pretty long, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and that's actually what inspired me to write this book. I have a whole chapter on being addicted to love, which was born out of my own direct experience, where it's pretty easy. You know, we can seem like we're on drugs when we first start dating somebody.
right, sure. There's a song, Addicted to Love, I think, that got a little traction a few years back.
Yes, might as well face it.
Yeah. Are we the only species that has bad habits and addictions? I mean, have other animals learned how to not repeat use with adverse consequences?
You know, it's a really great question. I haven't thought about it that much, and I don't want to anthropomorphize too much, but I don't see a lot of, you know, animals out on the savannah suffering from diabetes.
Yeah. Our brains developed this craving instinct. Did we do that for any good reason? Does this craving impulse ever help us?
Yes, I think it does. I think it helps us, you know, it's really set up so we'd have what's called context-dependent memory, so we'd remember where food is. So I think that the craving gets hijacked in modern day where every billboard we see, you know, things like crafted for your craving, or there's, you know, crave cereal and crave beef jerky and crave this and crave that. So I think advertisers certainly know that craving gets us to buy stuff. But it was really set up so we'd learn where to find sources of food rather than learn how to harvest tobacco for cigarettes or you know, coca leaves for cocaine or things like that.
Judson Brewer, again, his new book, The Craving Mind. You can find him at judsonbrewer.com. Appreciate the conversation, Judson. You do some interesting work here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Last week on the show, we learned how toxic stress in childhood can have lifelong consequences. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, I'll look at the next steps in Kansas City's transition to a single terminal airport. And 1 year after the biggest wildfire in state history, we'll check in with the mayor of Ashland, Kansas, and we'll discuss this year's fire season. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.